This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 172 was recorded on June 20th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to systematic trading and investing. And what a week in markets! From tanker attacks to Iran shooting down a U.S. drone this morning, to central bankers turning back toward more dovish monetary policy, to the China trade talks, to stocks opening at new all-time highs today, it's been a hell of a week, and we've got a fantastic show lined up for you. Many experts are expecting interest rates to fall much farther from here, and there are strong views on both sides of the U.S. dollar debate. But what will all of this mean for commodities, which are usually priced in dollars? Greg Weldon joins me as this week's feature interview guest to explore that question in full detail, starting with monetary policy and then reviewing what it means for everything from precious metals to energy to base metals to grains. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will address a listener question about crude oil forward curves, and we'll also have another of Patrick's famous post-game chart books to discuss all the exciting action in markets this week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get right to this S&P 500, which this morning opened at new all-time highs. What's going on?
Well, Patrick, I still continue to have many reservations about the economy. I think the bond market agrees with me about those reservations about the economy, but that's not what the stock market is paying attention to. We're living in this bad news is the new good news doctrine. Doesn't make sense to me, but it's been what's driving the market. They see Fed accommodation coming, more easy money drives risk assets higher, as counterintuitive as I think that really is. So what's going on here, Patrick, is the combination of market hopes of a Fed rate cut at the next meeting, plus the China trade negotiations being back on. I think where we're likely headed is that both of those hopes come true. In other words, we get some kind of China deal. I don't know what kind of deal, but I wouldn't be surprised if around the end of June we see some kind of a deal emerge. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do see an FOMC rate cut at the next meeting. If both of those things happen, it's likely to push the market even higher. Now, maybe that's your final sell the news moment and the topping cycle is over and that's it. But frankly, smart people learn from what's working, not what they think should be working. And what's working is liquidity is driving the market higher, regardless of what I think the fundamentals should be. So we can go into some more detail on this, Patrick. I've got some other questions I want to ask you about option strategies in the post-game segment when we get into your chart book. But basically what's going on here is I think that we're maybe headed toward a melt-up, which I don't think makes fundamental sense, but it appears that it's perhaps starting to happen.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar because it looked like it was started to recover and then came the Fed announcement and pretty much wiped out an entire week's progress higher. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, we did wipe out that entire week's worth of progress higher, but we didn't go lower than the previous low. At least we haven't yet. I won't be surprised if we do. Remember that we're reacting here to expectations. At some point, we're going to get an actual cut, not just expectations of a cut. And I wouldn't be surprised if that results in a really big knee-jerk down on the dollar index. What we're seeing now is a medium knee-jerk down on expectations that that cut might be coming next month. I think the bigger knee-jerk comes when we actually get the cut. But what happens after that? My expectation is that that knee-jerk lower is an opportunity to buy the dip because I think the dollar rally is set to continue because of the global dollar liquidity squeeze, which Brent Johnson and Jeff Snyder have described in different ways on this program. There's lots and lots of smart people who disagree with me, Patrick, including Greg Weldon, today's feature interview guest. So you'll hear his reasons for seeing it very differently than I see it. There's lots of reasons that they could be right. The reason that I think they'll be caught wrong-footed is because I don't think what's driving the dollar is entirely about the usual factors of interest rate differentials and so forth. I think it's about this global dollar liquidity squeeze, which Jeff Snyder has opined extensively about. I, too, could be wrong. Time will tell. And if I've got the dollar story wrong, I've definitely got the gold story wrong.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because we got a pretty big reaction on the news. So what's going on?
Well, it's deja vu to last week when I said, Patrick, I'm only going to tell you what's happened since we recorded the Energy Week episode just 24 hours ago, and it was still a long report. So we'll start with a very quick recap of what happened before this latest escalation today. There was a big spike up to range resistances on WTI on Tuesday morning in reaction to news of the ECB turning more dovish and a resumption of the U.S.-China trade talks. Then came the EIA inventory report, with crude oil drawing down 3.1 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, still showing a build of 643,000 barrels despite the national drawdown. Gasoline building 147,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 551,000 barrels. So we're finally seeing a crude drawdown after a string of consecutive crude oil builds over the last few weeks. Be very interesting to see where the trend takes us from here. The tape action was a pop up initially to range resistance, then a fade back down. But as we started to approach the close, we started trading higher. And eventually, I think some people might have had early word about what was coming on the geopolitical front, because even before the news came out, we started to see crude oil just melting up higher. And now, of course, we're seeing crude oil is way up at north of $57 as we're speaking Thursday afternoon. That is a direct result of Iran shooting down a U.S. drone and publicly admitting that they did so, causing a lot of people to be concerned about a further escalation of geopolitical tension in the Gulf. There's no limit to how much upside is possible in a Middle East conflict that has contagion risk to a larger war. Is that really the case here, or is Iran alone? Certainly, if Russia comes to Iran's aid, that changes the game dramatically. But if Iran is acting alone, I don't think it really does much to affect supply and demand fundamentals of oil, because Iran's oil is really mostly out of the market, except for the gray market action that continues to occur there. The risk is contagion beyond just Iran-U.S. conflict to something else, some bigger conflict. And I think that's what the market is afraid of. My view is that there is still a very good economic case for new lows below $50 if, and only if, the trend of stock builds continues and this whole geopolitical situation blows over somehow. If the geopolitics don't blow over, anything's possible and prices to the upside. That leaves me on the sidelines. I'm hoping to be short enough to know when to short this market when the prices peak out after all of this geopolitical tension blows over. But needless to say, that's a very difficult thing to time.
All right, Eric, it's time to move on to gold. I mean, we've had for over a year guest after guest talk about how important this 1350 overhead resistance on gold is. And here we are clearing that zone. What's on your mind when it comes to gold?
Well, woohoo, needless to say, this is a really big, important move. I want to clarify, though, it's a band of resistance between 1350 and 1375. Now, we did break past all of those numbers, almost testing 1400 already. And as we're speaking right now, Patrick, I'm looking at 1393 on my chart. So needless to say, the signs are that a big breakout past this very, very critical, it's been 5 years, Patrick, that we've been struggling to get past this resistance level at 1350 to 1375. That may be occurring now. But I want to stress, it may be occurring. There's a lot of good economic reasons for why, but hold on. We need to see a sustained breakout. When you have a technical level that's been in play for 5 years, you know, people were just declaring victory on Twitter 10 minutes after the breakout occurred outside of regular trading hours. That's crazy. You've got to see the price actually sustain during regular trading hours and get a daily close above those key levels? Well, we're going to get that in the next few minutes here, unless the market absolutely tanks. So it looks like we are beginning to see these confirmation signals. I think we need a lot more than just one day, though. And in this particular case, where we have so many geopolitical tensions, which are the kinds of things that tend to cause gold to spike up until the geopolitical tension blows over, if the whole Iran situation blows over, there's still room for this to reverse back to the downside. So, you know, it's definitely looking, the preponderance of evidence suggests that most likely we're seeing the beginning of a major and important breakout, one that I was not expecting. And if that's what happens, I'll be happy to admit having been wrong. But we're not quite there yet, folks. We need to see confirmation of this move, and it is still possible for this to be proven to be a false breakout. So I really don't think that the jury is in at this point, but so far, indications are that we're moving toward a move higher, and I could see it really, really accelerating from here if it is confirmed.
And now it's my turn to say wow, because the 10-year yield actually temporarily broke below 2%. It's trading a little bit above right now. But what's your thinking here? Like, the interest rates just keep going lower.
And I think they're going to continue to go lower. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I just closed half of my long position on 2-year Treasury futures on Wednesday evening. Not because I don't think that rates are going to continue to go lower, but I think we're seeing some froth in the market in reaction to the FOMC press release. And I think that it's possible that we'll get a significant pullback. So I took half of my long off and hope to catch a re-entry a little bit lower. But we'll see what happens. In any case, I do think that lower yields are coming. It's pretty clear to me that we are headed toward a recession in 2020. The fact that the stock market is melting up anyway is a little bit crazy, but I don't think it's being driven by economic fundamentals. I think it's being driven by liquidity and easy money policy. The frustration here is there haven't been any really good pullbacks for a long entry. I am already long those 2-year treasuries. As I said, I just closed half of that position, but not because I don't think we're not going to lower interest rates. I just think we're a little overdone here, and I'd like to catch a pullback for another long entry. In the meantime, you know, I've been saying this for weeks. It's hard to justify new longs when we've already moved so far so fast. I've been suggesting wait for the pullback, but boy, there hasn't been a pullback. We just keep going lower and lower in yields. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is commodities expert Greg Weldon. Now, Eric, why did we invite Greg onto the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Greg is a really solid guy. He's been around for a long time. But what I really like about him is he's one of the few commodity guys that really gets the macro and understands why macro is so important to the commodities market. And when I asked him off the air, Greg, you know, we're commodities, dude, we got to talk about, you know, precious metals and energy and base metals, and where do you want to start? And he's like, where do I want to start? Obviously, we got to start with the FOMC and monetary policy. That's what drives all of this. It doesn't make any sense to talk about commodities until we talk first about where the dollar is headed. And Greg and I disagree on the dollar. That's fine. The point is, he gets it. He understands that what really drives the commodity complex is a lot of macro driving factors, and he's very plugged into that. Not everybody in the commodities world is, and that's the reason that I really think he's a good guy to listen to when it comes to commodity markets.
And Eric, who's our sponsor this week?
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Although I personally am a global macro investor myself, it has long been known to investors around the world that systematic or quant-based strategies are profoundly effective at extracting returns from the market. Top hedge funds like Bridgewater Associates and Renaissance Technologies discovered this decades ago. And there's one podcast that covers this area of finance better than any other, TopTradersUnplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book explaining how these systematic strategies work. Just go to TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. And now let's move on to the feature interview coming up right after this.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Greg Weldon, the founder of Weldon Live, well-known commodities expert. Greg, everybody knows you as the commodities guy and probably is expecting me to dive right into commodities. But I think before we go there, we should talk about central banks, monetary policy, and the general condition of the world, because I think something you and I agree on is that to understand the commodities picture, you've got to understand the monetary policy picture first. So where do we start in terms of the situation that the world is in and where we're headed? Do you want to talk about the Fed or the ECB? Where do you want to start?
I don't know. You got 3 or 4 hours and we can discuss it all. What I find interesting is, you know, the commodities angle, because, you know, in the business, 35 years, started on the trading floor in the COMEX in the World Trade Center back in the early 80s. And what I see is that everything has been commoditized. So we are the commodity guys because we look at everything. And so it includes stocks and bonds, and everything is now a commodity because of this secular kind of credit bubble that goes all the way back to 1971. And now you're at a point, and it's becoming more and more obvious, as particularly today, as we're recording, when Mario Draghi is in the headlines and this continued push for even, you know, more stimulus beyond QE, beyond negative actual deposit rates and official policy rates. And that, to me, I mean, you're at some kind of mathematical tipping point potentially, where the amount of money needed now to stimulate, given the growth in credit, given the growth in sovereign debt, especially in the U.S., going back even just to 2008 and 2009, is grown exponentially to the point where I'm not sure they can either A, have the political will to pump that much money. They probably will, because they'll do whatever they have to do to avoid, you know, falling into the debt deflation scenario. That's the biggest fear among central bankers. And from that perspective, the question is, what if it stops working? What if it only works to keep things where they are? Because that's not good enough. You need growth. With all this debt and all this credit creation, you need growth to basically keep this thing floating. So I think Mario Draghi made a big misstep the first quarter of last year when they failed to raise rates, when GDP was strong in a lot of member nations, when inflation was above target in several places, particularly Germany, that fed in through all the Eastern European states as well. They could have raised rates just even to zero to give themselves some back-end firepower. The Fed's done a masterful job of that. But now it's almost like the Fed is going to have to be the central banker to the world, because they're the ones that has actually created some room to stimulate by cutting interest rates.
I want to talk about that point of the Fed being the central banker to the world specifically, because I think it's just paramount importance in the environment that we have right now. The U.S. dollar, if you look at the fundamentals and what the Fed has done and the expansion of the balance sheet, on the face of it, a lot of people would say, okay, this has got to be negative for the U.S. dollar. Just look at what they're doing to debase the value of the currency with all of the balance sheet expansion and so forth. But I've really come around to an opposite view, which is, as bad as it is, it's worse in Europe and Japan. And as much as it seems to us like it doesn't make sense, the safety trade for most people is going to be into the dollar. Most institutions around the world will still see U.S. treasuries as their safety trade. And I think it continues to provide a very counterintuitive boost to the dollar relative to other currencies, even in the face of what seem to be fundamentals that ought to be dollar bearish if you weren't considering the other currencies. Where do you stand on this whole debate? Do you think that we should be shorting the dollar here at its recent highs, or do you think that the dollar is going to get squeezed even higher?
First thing I would say is, bam, I mean, you just nailed it. I mean, it really does seem to be a kind of counterintuitive. What I would say is there's a massive kind of conflict, almost a war going on right now in the dollar. And there's kind of three fundamental forces that I perceive. Number one is all the dollar debt that's been created. So this is maybe what's holding the dollar up a little more, because really, if you go back to last, like, November, you had a major disconnect between the correlation of the dollar index and the forward Fed funds futures market and the implied rates. So, and what's interesting is, as that has occurred, you could even say that the fact that the dollar hasn't come off with that has actually intensified the push lower in yields in the fixed income market, and that there's dollar demand. I mean, I'll throw a curveball at you just out of the blue. Take Angola, okay, where the Kwanzaa is the local currency. It's down like, you know, relative to gold, it's down like 500% in the last 10 years. This is a country that's an OPEC member, produces more oil per day than right now Nigeria does, and their currency is just getting annihilated to the point where you can't accept the local currency. You can't use the local currency locally, you know, for goods and services. You have the same situation developing in a lot of places around the world. Venezuela is an obvious one. Argentina, it's infiltrating into Colombia. You got a situation in Pakistan. We know Iran. You can take even places like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. There are currencies that are getting slammed. And in this sense, it creates demand for dollars. So I think the dollar is being held up by that. But the fundamentals now going forward for me is if the Fed is going to be the central bank to the world, because I totally believe that, the dollar is absolutely in play on the downside. And now that Trump is tweeting about Draghi, I mean, come on, man, you just took it up a notch. It's like, you know, the old Seinfeld thing, Mandelbaum, Mandelbaum, taking it up a notch here now. And I think if you take out 9502 on the dollar index, the cash dollar index, that's a major technical breakdown. The entire rally has kind of been Fibonacci retracement almost to the bigger picture. It's always the dollar as the relief valve. I've been doing this 35 years. It's always the dollar. And relative to gold, the dollar since 1971 is down 86%. That's going to continue to be the case. So I think the dollar is very vulnerable. It's in play, and that's what makes gold so attractive here.
And when you say it's in play, do you mean that you believe that the next move for the dollar is down, or do you mean that the game is on and it could go either way before that happens?
Well, it could go. I mean, I think they're going to play to the downside. The question, of course, is if the demand is so great in some of these other places in the world, you know, how effective are they going to be? I would say that's already in question because you have the, you know, the Fed funds and now even the interest rate differentials. So really covering like the U.S. German bond yield differentials, again, highly correlated to the dollar. And more recently, that's kind of broken down to some degree. So when you see those kinds of things, you start to ask yourself, why is the dollar holding up here when normally an intra-market dynamic like this that is bigger picture would drive it lower? And I think that the Fed will be as aggressive as they have to be. They can't let the dollar break out. It goes to 104. It's another 5-6% to the upside. And you're looking at a 30% five-year rate of change. That has always been problematic in terms of the Fed's concerned about the credibility of their inflation target. They can't let the dollar go higher if they're concerned about the credibility of their inflation target. Case closed. So I think dollar's in play to the downside if it breaks 9502, because we could be wrong.
And what happens, let's suppose that we don't break 9502 and we do see an upside breakout from 98, which seems to be where this overhead resistance is. And let's say in a few months we're at 100 on the dollar index. Let's talk about some of the knock-on effects. What kind of damage can that cause and how does it play out and affect other markets?
Sure. I mean, first, if it takes on 98, it's not stopping at 100. It's going to 104. That's kind of your even bigger picture, longer term, 61% Fibonacci retracement level. That was the high, you know, in the 2016-17 rally. So from that perspective, what happens is it depresses commodity prices. It then affects emerging markets. We were on the precipice of this. And to me, this is kind of why Powell had to, you know, do an about face. It wasn't so much the U.S. economy. People look at the U.S. economy and saying, how can the Fed want to be, you know, a little, you know, beyond neutral to the easy side now when the economy is seemingly, you know, a juggernaut? Well, first of all, the economy is not a juggernaut. We could trash that to pieces, all right, at least in the underlying kind of pipeline for the economy. But the really bigger picture is what was happening was all of a sudden you had emerging market currencies going down, emerging market. The commodities were going down, base metals cracked, you know, ags are at new lows. A lot of this is a dollar influence. And when emerging market stock index started to roll, come on, the timing was almost golden. I mean, Powell's now changing his tune because they can't allow emerging markets to return as a deflationary risk when you're so far really out of the range of where you're going to be going forward on your inflation target. And if they're worried about the credibility of their inflation target, and several members of the Fed have mentioned this in recent speeches, and they don't do that by accident. I don't think they can really accept the dollar going higher. So I feel that there's monetary policy is kind of aimed at this thing more so than the real economy, which is kind of maybe causing some people to be confused.
Greg, obviously precious metals have to come into this conversation. Based on what you've said about how you believe that the dollar is in play to the downside here, I'm assuming that you must already be long gold. But I want to also talk about where we are in this gold market. Let's assume at least some of our listeners don't yet have a position, because even for someone with a bullish outlook, I have to wonder just below this important resistance level whether it's the right place to be putting on new longs. So how do you see the gold market, and what would you tell someone that doesn't already have a position?
It's a great question. That's a two-pronged question, so I'll give you a two-pronged answer. I mean, first, from the bigger picture, yes, we're long gold. We actually are long gold from 1196, so from below 1200. And yes, you have resistance here. You have tried to penetrate this resistance on numerous occasions. It was actually 1377, and it's 1365. Then it got down to around 1345, so you have this descending, you know, lower highs. Well, you broke through the first one. You're kind of poised. What I said yesterday is that the gold and even the GDX, the gold miners, to me, look like they're on a launching pad. You know, I mean, we're just waiting for the countdown here, and the countdown would theoretically be the dollar. Is there risk to gold? Sure there is. If the dollar breaks out, there's risk to gold. But that gets back to the bigger picture situation where the dollar is basically near or at new highs, or it's at a very high level relative to the past couple of years. And gold is up a couple hundred bucks from its lows. In a normal situation, gold probably trading 1050 to 1150 right now, based on the correlation with the dollar. So what I do is take the dollar index and divide it by gold. And it's a very simple thing to look at that is basically the gold adjusted value of the dollar. And herein is where the big picture takes shape, because again, if the dollar is always the relief valve and gold is the flip side of that, it's already in play. So from that perspective, we do believe gold is going to break out here. We like silver. We like gold. We like the gold mining shares. You know, if it doesn't here, I think the downside is somewhat limited. So to me, I look at a breakout and then look at what's the upside potential, and it's significant. I mean, you get above this 1377 level, there is virtually no resistance until you're into the 1700s, the high 1700s. That's a nice first move. And that would come in context, theoretically, with a breakdown in the dollar. Otherwise, we're kind of just ebb and flow here and continue to go. But I think the downside is really not that much. And I think gold has proven that to us already. So yeah, we're locked and loaded. We think this is big picture stuff. And the biggest picture thing that I can say about this is you are starting to see a crack in the confidence of everyone in paper, in all paper, because currencies, sovereign debt, it's all IOUs. And at some point you're kind of at the precipice of this thing of, what currency that's a paper currency do you even want to hold? And I think that's the biggest case for gold. And I think ECB is going to stimulate from here. They're going to create consumer loans at minus 1%. I mean, come on. That's the biggest case for gold yet. So we like it a lot right here.
We had Danielle DiMartino Booth on the program the other day, and she pointed out the change in language that the Fed has moved from the zero lower bound to the effective lower bound. And Danielle thinks that they're very intentionally setting the stage for negative interest rates. How far do you think we can get into negative interest rate territory before something really big breaks? Obviously, there's a cash hoarding incentive that at some point it's better for people, rather than pay a negative interest rate, to just take their money out of the financial system and store it in cash. And of course, there isn't enough cash for everybody to do that. So you could have a run on the entire financial system if you weren't careful there. How far do you think they're going to push this on this next round that we go through with central bankers? And what are the risks?
Well, I mean, I would agree with Danielle. I mean, she's obviously brilliant. She has great insight into the Fed. And, you know, I watch the language like a hawk. I mean, I'm from the old school, man, when you had to watch the repos every day and figure out what the stop out rate and what, you know, it was very much of a nuance, you know. So it's kind of going back to that a little bit. What I would say is this is kind of where our star comes into play, and where the Fed is preparing for this. They know. And I think if you go all the way back to when they started to hike rates, what was really interesting was they wanted to get rates higher so they could use rates as the next stimulus instead of having to blow out the balance sheet again. So that's really interesting to me, because, you know, the language then was pretty apparent before they ended, you know, the roll off of the balance sheet. But I don't know. I mean, my thought process immediately when you asked me that question is, by the time the U.S. gets to negative interest rates, the proverbial S has already hit the fan.
Okay. So, and do you think it's Japan or Europe or both? Where does it hit the fan first?
Absolutely Europe. Europe, to me, has been the setup the entire time. It really has. I mean, do I have to go through the litany? And you know, it sounds like a broken record. But, man, you are here. You're at this time and space has kind of converged here. And it's time to see how things are going to play out in a bigger picture way that may not be the end result that it's always been. So to me, that's kind of where it all gets interesting. In Europe, I mean, you look at the fracture you have in Europe, it's kind of gotten lost in the translation. This is something people don't talk about anymore. You have separatist governments in Italy and Spain. Last June, I mean, Spain had to include, you know, the Catalonians and the Basque Party into their coalition government, or they wouldn't have been able to seize power. And you know what's going on with Italy. I mean, the league is now rising in power. And so this is a huge dynamic in terms of the potential for blowups to where some of these countries go back to their currencies because – so Italy wants to expand their budget deficit, all right? And they want to expand it not to a level above 3, which is the limit in Maastricht and their whole treaty. And what's interesting now is all of a sudden the EU Commission wants to impose penalties. They've been ignoring penalties for 2 decades. And all of a sudden they're picking on Italy, who wants to lift their budget deficit, which theoretically goes against the spirit of the agreement because they're expanding their budget deficit, but they're not exceeding the rules and they're going to be threatened with fines. This to me was a bad move by the EU Commission because, or whoever is the ruling party that makes these decisions in the EU, because you put Italy in harm's way and you potentially giving them a way out. So I think, there's so much risk in Europe. That's just one of them that comes about. And now, again, the biggest risk is policy, monetary policy. And you look at places like, Switzerland, -1.25 at the low end of their official target range. You look at places like Denmark and Sweden, that makes the ECB still look like child's play. Could the ECB go to -1.5? There's a lot of talk about the LTROs, and what they could do is create almost a two-tiered system. So they wouldn't cut deposit rates. They might actually raise deposit rates, but provide funding on the back end to banks through the LTROs, where the banks could offer consumer loans at negative interest rates. If that's not the case for gold over any paper currency, I don't know that I've seen it in 35 years of doing this.
Now, as we look at the stock market versus the bond market and what bond yields are doing, to me, you're getting a pretty clear recession is coming signal from the bond market. The stock market seems to just want to party on. And that leaves us trying to decide who's right. In terms of looking to commodities to find a tiebreaker, whether it's the copper chart or anything else, what are you seeing in some of the base commodities that might tell you about the direction of the economy in the next 12 to 18 months?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned base commodities. So I would look at that twofold outside of energy, all right, would be obviously the base metals, which are kind of in line with that recessionary. It's a more of a global market, LME. And you look at aluminum is making a new low here. It's through its 61% retracement. So it's suggesting, hey, this is not a correction in an ongoing bull market anymore. And relative to even the Trump rally in stocks, and you look at copper, I mean, these are not like commodities that are in hugely short supply outside of zinc. So that's number one is the base metal. So we're watching those. And man, they're kind of close to cracking. If you get below 259 on the U.S. copper futures contract, that would be a major technical breakdown. On the other hand, if you look at something like the agricultural commodities, holy mackerel, love them right here. We have kind of been laying out this scenario almost for the last 18 months. It's kind of bigger picture. So I don't know how much you want me to get into that right here, but that's where maybe some opportunity lies. That ties in with the trade war, which is what's scaring the bond market so much, but stock market doesn't care. I think there's a reckoning that has to come there. And unfortunately, I think when you look at the Fed and what might have to push them to their next action, I always kind of come up with the question of if they don't act fast enough and meet the timeline laid out by the Fed funds futures market and the 2-year and 5-year treasury note, then that's going to be risk to the stock market. And that may have to be the catalyst. So, and that may be the thing that breaks the dollars back too, by the way. But from commodities perspective, like the ags, specifically, the oilseed market.
Let's talk about the grains specifically, because we've had this flooding situation in the central United States, which has just caused utter mayhem for farmers. A lot of corn crops just not being planted at all this year. And as much as we had this kind of deflation signal of the grains almost falling off a cliff to super low numbers a few months ago, the last couple of months, it's been just straight up, at least on the front months, the immediate delivery, which are affected by this. What are we seeing in the term structure of the grains, and what does it tell us? Because when you say there's an opportunity here in the grains, it seems to me like it's kind of overdone to the upside, at least on those front month contracts. Are you still buying there, or where do you see these opportunities?
I would agree with you 100% on corn. Okay. So in the commodities business, quote unquote, grains is, corn and wheat and rice and so on and so forth. That's why I say oil seeds, because it is the soybean market. That is the potential huge opportunity here. And what I find interesting, again, not to hype on this point, but having done this for so long, I mean, I remember the day when $9 soybeans would have been like, holy mackerel, the world's coming to an end, So the fact is that, yes, you had a bumper crop of soybeans really for the last 2 years in the U.S. It was interrupted by a big drought in Argentina that cut the soybeans, and that's a major supplier of soybean meal. That's what kind of brings China into the mix as a trade dynamic. It's not so much about soybeans as it is really they take the soybeans and make soybean meal out of it. There was a time, actually, just to kind of go off track for a second, we tied into China, where when the trade war kind of first started and tariffs were first affecting these things, the U.S. was still selling soybeans to China. They were selling it to Argentina, who was then shipping them to China, and so on and so forth. So the point of all that is, yeah, we've had bumper crops, but demand is at a record as well. So what happens if crops don't stay at a record or don't continue to grow? That's a problem. Because the margin for error, particularly in soybeans, is razor thin. And you wouldn't really think that given the price action of these things recently, because it's a lot of headlines, it's a lot of psychology, you know, and it is a bumper crop, which gets the lion's share of the headlines. Coming into the near term, what you have now, particularly with the weather, particularly with the rain, particularly with how wet it's been, you have a situation where the soybean crop was delayed, not as much as corn. But the problem is soybeans. So we look at that. The crop is delayed quite a bit. And more importantly is the emergence numbers. All right. So the crop that's actually emerging now, way behind schedule, way behind last year, way behind the five-year average. I mean, half of it at one point. So that was maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago. So from that perspective, not only do you have less acreage planted in the U.S. this year, okay, but now with a later emerging crop, you're running the risk of lower yields than have been estimated. And if you don't get the kind of crop that the USDA is looking for, which is actually lower than last year, you're going to have a problem because demand is still kind of screaming. Demand from China is a little bit less. So that's maybe a wild card to see what happens. If that's just the trade situation or what actually there is some less demand, there's some thoughts around some of the, you know, animal issues in China, maybe crimping demand for feed. But that's more, again, in corn. So when we look at soybeans, I mean, the balance sheet in soybeans could really tighten up dramatically. And if you look at where you were 2 years ago, when the situation was much less bullish, it became a thing of, is it getting less bearish yet? And it just flipped because of the weather from less bearish to bullish. And I've been saying, you know, waiting for this opportunity, because the people I think are misunderstanding or, you know, underestimating the tightness of the balance sheet potentially and what this could mean in terms of not having another bumper crop could be bullish unto itself. So we like soybeans right here. And frankly, they just broke out yesterday. So they didn't have the move corn has had. And corn's overblown. I mean, it's completely kind of in the short term out of control. That's not the case in soybeans. So we really like the soybean market.
Is there a pairs trade there that's short corn and long soybeans to arbitrage that difference that's developed?
Yeah, I looked at that. Of course, you know, it's one of the first things I look at because they try and consider every angle. I'd just rather be long soybeans. It's just a better trade. It's cleaner. It just makes more sense to me. I don't want to necessarily get bogged down on a leg that may or may not work. I mean, it could be sold, but if you get the whole complex to go and then the dollar breaks, I don't really necessarily want to be short corn. So I will say this, though, and just to add on to the answer here, I mean, the DBA, okay, the ETF for the agriculture commodities is a valid way for probably some of your listeners to play this that don't trade futures or have commodity counts and so on. It is the ETF, the stock that tracks a number of commodities, including soybeans and sugar. So to me, this has so underperformed, has been so depressed, is so underowned. No one's invested in this kind of thing. So when you look at the longer term chart, and then when you overlay kind of the DBA against the DBA versus the CRB index of all commodities, I mean, it's almost like you're getting these things on the cheap right now.
Greg, on Tuesday morning of this week, when we're taping this interview, we've seen just a dramatic rally in energy prices. The price of crude oil, $51 and about 70 cents this morning, just before we taped this interview. As we've been talking, we're now looking at $53.71. So we're about $2 up in the last couple hours here. I'm not aware of any specific news other than the ongoing people are worried about the Iran military escalation potential. What do you think is driving this? What's going on, and what should we be looking for?
Fear, greed, and hope driving this one. I mean, if you kind of break it down, you have the two sides. And what I said yesterday, I actually wrote a special energy piece on Friday. And what I came to the conclusion is, this is a market that looks really bearish, both fundamentally and technically. But the geopolitical situation is such that it may prohibit being short. So that's kind of where I'm at with it. I'd probably like to be short. I mean, I know I'd like to be short. It's just a question of what's the risk here for the potential blow up geopolitically. And I'm sure you know some of the same people I know in the hedge fund industry. There are guys out there that refuse to go home over the weekend short crude. They just won't do it. And that's kind of like the psychology, I think, that applies right here. If you look at the fundamentals, U.S. is pumping out, you know, 12.4, 12.3, just massive amounts. When you have the demand numbers being cut everywhere, you're looking at a significant daily build of crude at a time when in the U.S. inventories are now tracking up towards the upper end of the five-year range. That in of itself is bearish. And if you play this out and kind of project what the IEA and what OPEC, and we dissected both of these reports, really lengthy, in-depth reports that were fascinating to me, you know, you could construct numbers around the differential between supply and demand growth that's being projected for the third and fourth quarter to where you could potentially get a build here in the U.S., you know, back above 500 million barrels in the commercial inventories. That's not going to be bullish. So what you do then, or what I do then, is, you know, we want to go to the swaps. So the swaps are interesting here because the near term, you're kind of in a potential contango situation where, you know, you've had this bullish backwardation in crude for a while. It kind of got whacked and it went back into a backwardation. And now it's getting into contango again, meaning that the near term contract is priced at a lower price than the deferred. And the market, by essentially pricing it that way, is trying to encourage storage. And that is interesting because if storage is encouraged, it's also a reflection of the fact there's not much demand. So you don't need the crude for immediate delivery because there's not the demand for it. And that to me is interesting. But if you look at the more deferred, if you go, for example, the December of this year to the December of next year, the 12-month December swap rate, it's actually still in a bullish backwardation. Now, some of that's the cost to carry and insurance and so on and so forth, but it's not in contango. So there is a real kind of bifurcated thought process around crude oil. To me, the technicals are kind of the key. And from that perspective, if you take out the lows that we set over the, you know, since the end of May, you know, there's two kind of spike lows that were kind of, if you look at the candlestick, it was almost tailed reversal type lows. And I watched the, look at the August contract. I mean, it's down just around $50. It's above 50. If those lows get taken out, I mean, the trade is to be short. The question is the geopolitical risk too high? And I'm not sure about the answer to that. I'm really not.
Greg, you are in Jupiter, Florida, just north of Palm Beach, a very affluent area. And something that I've noticed is there's kind of a disconnect when you see the kind of wealth that hangs out in South Florida. They don't really know what's going on in the market from day to day because a lot of them don't have to. But when big things start to change, they seem to get the scent pretty quickly. What are you seeing being in the private wealth management business in South Florida? What is the mood of the wealthiest investors that you run into down there? And how are they looking? Are they reacting to the central banks or are they not paying attention to it? What's the mood there?
That's a great question, Eric. I mean, it really is. And, you know, I would say, first of all, I'm probably the least affluent person here in Jupiter, Florida. So, I mean, you know, yeah, there is a lot of wealth, particularly Jupiter Island, of course, and then Palm Beach Island. So, you know, I'm more inland. But from the perspective of the people that are around me that are smarter than me, wealthier than me, you know, however it is, these are people that are so successful in their own businesses, it kind of blows your mind when you visit their homes. I mean, it's kind of, you know, you're in awe. And the perspective that I get from them is I'm getting calls from them now. They're worried. And they're worried for the kind of reason that I laid out earlier in terms of, you know, and it's not, they don't put it in these words. They never announce it in this way. They never literally tell you that we're worried about central banks. We're worried about how much paper is being created. And we think someday there might be a day of reckoning, so on and so forth. They're just seeing kind of what's happening. They feel it, I guess, is the best way to talk about it. And these are people that are probably are so successful for one reason, that they've learned to listen to their instincts. And these are instincts that are now coming out and causing them to call me and ask me about what I think about two specific things. Number one, and this will go to your South Florida thing, and why it has absolutely been so insulated in the psychology here. And that's because of the housing market. And that's because of politics. And that's because of the migration of people to Florida. So real estate values here have been on fire to the point where it's ridiculous. And so that's number one. I would say you're reaching some kind of peak, but that could go on because of what we could see mortgage rates do. I could easily create a scenario where you see the 30-year mortgage rate below 3%. So that's one of the firepowers that the Fed has created because, you know, everything's kind of going down in yield right now, but the spreads, the treasury mortgage rate spreads are going up. So you're creating a lot of room there. So it could be insulated for a while longer, but there is a concern here. And it is a concern of big picture magnitude where people are asking me, should I put some of my money into, get this, municipal and mortgage bonds or gold. Now, they ask mortgage bonds because they're in the mortgage business, a lot of these people, or at least they're very, you know, they're property owners and so on and so forth. So, and then the muni bond thing was interesting. I had a conversation yesterday with someone and I'm kind of like, well, muni bonds may benefit from this, but, you know, look at the state of the financial condition of some of the states and some of the municipalities. I'm not sure I want to really own those longer term, but it always comes back to gold, man. I mean, it really does. And when I start to hear and see, you know, get the tells, kind of anecdotal tells, I call them, you know, that's something I've learned to really pay attention to. And right now it is fear. And right now it is protection. And right now it is, should I go to cash, or do I buy some bonds or even gold? And to the point where there is a fear about gold is pretty interesting too. And I kind of tell them, I mean, if you start to look at the upside versus the downside, to me, the upside in the stock market, even if, you know, the Fed were to meet the expectation that's already baked into the Fed funds forward strip and the 2 and 5 year treasury notes, they're at 175 practically. All right. They're pricing in the next year's Fed funds is pricing in now, you know, a fifth rate cut below 1.5. All right. So from that perspective, I fear that if you don't meet those expectations, and this is Powell, this is not Bernanke, this is not Yellen. They were students of the Depression. Powell in Jackson Hole speech made it quite clear. He's a student of the 70s inflation, and he vowed not to let that happen again. And boy, if he wasn't successful, because he probably went, and I did a piece in December, a bridge too far. So from that perspective, it does kind of lay out to how people are perceiving things. And the perception is fear. The perception is protection. And the perception is even, should I go to cash? And then that lays some of the big tech. I mean, if passive investors, you know, wealthy individuals start to rotate capital or get out entirely, that's one of the reasons we like the gold mining shares. If we get some rotation of capital and some of these guys are more comfortable buying stocks than a commodity like gold, even though they can buy it through the GLD, I think there's great potential there. So, you know, I have my own feelings about the big tech stocks and their vulnerabilities on many, many different levels. The volume is dried up. These stocks are so high priced. If people go to liquidate, you're not going to have buyers of big blocks of shares. It's too expensive. And it could be a vacuum of buyers. And it could be a real bad scenario in some of the tech space. So I think it drives people to cash, or it drives people to gold, or some of the wealthy people I talk to down here, gold mining shares.
Greg, what's your feeling on gold versus gold mining shares? Traditionally, the argument has been, you know, you get more leverage with gold mining shares. Of course, you're a futures trader. You know how to get the leverage if you wanted to in the gold itself. So let's assume you have the sophistication to be able to achieve whatever leverage you want. Do you think the play here in terms of the best opportunity, best risk reward, is in the shares or in the actual bullion?
That's a good question. That's a really tough one to answer. It's been not advantageous to own a mining shares versus gold recently. I think that that may change. So from that perspective, you know, I mean, the GDX is the thing to look at, you know, for your really adventurous types that are willing to jump out of a plane or something. I mean, the Nugget, the NUGT, is a leveraged ETF on the mining shares, risk capital only, you know, buyer beware. But I mean, that could be a phenomenal way to play it. I do believe that if you get some rotation of capital, depending, because it's not like the Fed is tightening here. So if they're easing, it does make it a little less violent potentially. I'm not saying the market's like going to come down hard. I could see kind of just a cascade, a rotation, a reallocation of capital. And all of a sudden, you know, the indexes are down and this is kind of forcing the Fed's hand, which only plays into if gold's taken off, you're going to see money move into gold mining shares. There's no investment there whatsoever. And that's been part of the reason they've underperformed. No one's been able to even raise money to a large degree. And that leaves you open to mergers and acquisitions, which we've started to see, which is a total wild card and bonus potentially. So I could potentially see some relocation of capital that would benefit the gold mining shares in an initial phase of a breakout. I would even go back now to part of our earlier conversation and say one of the risks to gold, as I'm kind of thinking about this today, do central banks want to like continue to ease like crazy and see gold break out? Maybe there's a thought process here that they're going to resist in whatever way they resist. And people say, do they manipulate the markets? And I say, I've been watching this for 35 years. They've always manipulated the markets. There's nothing new. So could they step on gold and keep it depressed? They might. I might suggest they've already tried. I don't think they would ultimately be successful, but that is one of the risks to, you know, being long gold from here, like you say, at a higher level.
Greg, several years ago, you wrote a book called Gold Trading Bootcamp. I understand that you have created now a video gold investing bootcamp that's a little more substantial than just the book. Tell us a little bit about that project. What brought it about? Why are you doing this now, and what does it involve?
That's a good question. Thank you. What brought this about was my publisher, or my agent, actually, who has been after me for the last 4 years to write a second book on gold. And, you know, I really wanted to do that when the time was right. And, you know, I needed the catalyst to get me to do it, because it's probably the hardest thing I've done, you know, in terms of work in my career, was writing a book, the first one. I know how to do it more now, so it would be easier, but it's still a really monumental task. So, you know, she's been pursuing me and so on and so forth. And just in the last year or so, seeing this big picture crystallize, seeing the technical dynamic and go, I mean, it's everything. To me, again, this is like a crystallization of this next cycle that goes back to 2006 when I wrote the original book. There's a lot of similarities. We have created this tremendous amount of credit against a paper asset. Okay. In this case, it's equities. All right. In the case in 2005, 6, and 7, it was housing. And it was an asset that basically you had the unrealized profits in those assets that you borrowed against. And you were confident that central banks would always protect your back, because in 2005, 6, the belief was housing will never go down. Home prices will never go down. It's almost the same now. I mean, investors have been kind of, you know, brainwashed by central banks into believing stocks never go down and stay down. So from that perspective, I see this as a very similar situation risk-wise, where to cause the next reflation, they're going to have to do so much and so much more than then, that this is going to be big, and it's going to be the next big bull leg in gold. So, and I'm not like a gold bug. I mean, we actually, you know, got bearish in gold after the 2011 top and rode it to the downside for a while too. So, you know, I'm very much either to take either side of gold. But in this case, I just think it's the most obvious glaring thing to me. And when I start to get questions from not only my clients, but just my friends and stuff about investing in gold, there's interest out there. And rather than answer all these questions individually, particularly for our clients, I decided I can create the material for the book by putting together a boot camp for my clients. And then, you know, I'd use that material. Well, the boot camp just became enormous. And what a project, but what a great project. Really enjoyed doing it. Going back to the history of gold, how you can invest in gold, whether it's futures or coins and bars or ETFs or the individual mining shares. I break all of that down. Some of the risk reward dynamics that I would apply theoretically to creating a portfolio of metals investments against other, you know, being a part of your bigger portfolio. And then took it down to the history of gold, to the history of the dollar, to the history of this whole credit bubble that began in 71. You want to take it back even to FDR? You could. But from that perspective, then, where are we now in the bigger picture? I think, to me, it's a 5-part video series. It's about 5 hours of video. Me personally, charged as a presentation, it's like you're going to a conference 5 days in a row for an hour a day. It's over 500 pages of charts and material and text. So you have all of that together as the comprehensive guide to how to invest in gold and why now is such a critical time to be investing in gold.
Okay, Greg, please tell our listeners where they can find out about the Gold Investing Bootcamp video product, but also give us a quick summary of what you do with Weldon Live and what else people can expect to find at WeldonOnline.com.
Sure. Well, I mean, WeldonOnline.com, we are a CTA, number one. So, you know, we don't go out and hawk money, because we trade futures and, we use math that potentially creates returns that are kind of maybe above average. But with that, you incur higher risk. So, but the real crux of the business is the Weldon Live. It really is. It's a daily research publication that covers the globe. We do everything. We break it down into a macro piece every day, and then we have fixed income, foreign exchange, stock indexes and ETFs globally, the metals, base and precious, energy and ags. And we have specific trading recommendations in all of those sectors every day that we follow with hard stops, so on and so forth. We track the trades. It's called Trade Lab. It's part of Weldon Live. So that's a subscription service that is sold on WeldonOnline.com. You can come on and access a free trial if you haven't had one before. And then the bootcamp we just added, just finished it. It's at the bottom of our webpage. There's kind of a big video that gives you more information on it. It's me talking to the camera and so on and so forth. So that's available and for sale on the website immediately.
Fantastic. And again, the URL for that is Weldon Online, WELDON Online.com. Greg, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Greg come on to the show. You know, I would listen to the interview, and while I agreed or disagreed with a few of his different points, but what really caught me was his conversation on gold. And obviously, we have gold moving. I want to even talk about it with a chart in just a moment when we get to the chart book. But I think the big debate, of course, is what's the best way to express the trade? Do you go into bullion itself, or do you play it through the gold miners? And I find this a fascinating debate because the market capitalization of the entire gold miner space is so small that it makes up the same market cap of just one tech company. Like, so if there's any half decent allocation of portfolio capital towards the gold miners, there simply isn't enough market cap out there without it resulting in some sort of an extraordinary move in the miners. I think there's some real asymmetry in that space. You know, gold itself is going to move as a great investment, but if gold is really going to kick, I think there's room for the gold miners to really get some momentum there. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, as you say, the gold and dollar issue really is so central and it's so important. I have continued, as you know, to feel that probably Jeff Snyder, Brent Johnson's side of the story is where I'm siding for now. It is very, very possible that Greg could be right. And, you know, the argument for gold is very strong here. You've got what appears to be a reversal of central bank policy, not just the Fed, but the ECB too. We're headed back toward accommodation, lower rates, probably eventually moving back to either QE or some other form of unconventional stimulus. So the arguments in favor of gold are very strong here. Now, the counter argument is the Jeff Snyder and also Brent Johnson makes a different argument, really, both favoring a big dollar rally here, which could really be a big headwind for gold. I think we may be moving into that regime that we've anticipated on this program for a few years now, which is eventually the dollar and gold move up together. Maybe that's already upon us. It's very interesting to see, but I can't stress strongly enough. It's not quite in the bag yet. It seems like we have a breakout happening here in gold. It's only the first day. We're just waiting as we're speaking right now. We haven't even got the first daily close above those key levels. And as we're speaking, it appears very likely that we're going to have that close in the next few minutes. But, you know, we need to see more than just one day in order to declare decisively that a five-year resistance line has been broken out above. And perhaps it's happening. Looks like it's happening. But it's not decided quite yet. So let's wait and see what happens.
Now, Eric, I want to move on into the chart book. But before we get to the charts that I prepared, one of our listeners sent you a tweet asking to explain what's going on with the term structure between West Texas Intermediate as well versus Brent. And so on this chart, can you give us an explanation of what you're seeing?
Patrick, the topic here is forward curves in the crude oil market and what makes them take the shape that they take. And the first thing I want to say about that is, frankly, this is more religion than science. I have some very strong views about why the curves look the way they do. But frankly, other people that are very experienced in this field have different views about what drives these curves. Eventually, what I'd like to get to is an interview with Chris Cook someday, who's got as much fascination as I do with this subject, where we can really go deep on this. But just to address this listener's question, maybe as a holdover, and let us know, folks, on Twitter, if there's enough interest in an interview going deep just on this subject. But looking at this chart on page two, how is it possible that Brent has the most expensive contract by far is the front month, and the price goes down? In other words, backwardation. As you go further out in time on the delivery curve, the price keeps going down. That condition of backwardation indicates tight supply, and that certainly jives with geopolitical events, so it all seems to make sense. But how is it possible that the WTI curve, that's the U.S. crude oil benchmark as opposed to the European benchmark, how is it possible that we have basically the same geopolitical conditions, but the WTI curve is showing some contango at the front of the curve? That is, the first few months, that curve is sloping up before it eventually rolls over and turns back down again. And the answer is entirely because, or I should say, my version of this religion says the answer is entirely because the front of the WTI curve is driven by storage dynamics in Cushing, Oklahoma, more than anything else. And that is a direct result of the fact that unlike the Brent contract, which is cash settled and it's based on North Sea Brent oil prices in the spot market, there is no actual taking delivery of those Brent futures contracts. They're all cash settled. In the case of WTI, you can actually take delivery from the tank farm in Cushing, Oklahoma. And what that means is it creates a very interesting dynamic between the people that are rolling forward their positions and the people that physically own tank storage in Cushing, Oklahoma. So what's happening is the guys that are storing oil expect to be paid for that oil. And the way they get paid for that oil is they say, look, I'm not going to roll my short position. They own oil in a tank. That's their long side. They're not taking any market risk. They own an equal number of crude oil futures contracts, which are short. So their short position in the futures market counters out their long position in the physical market. They're holding on to that oil, and the profit they make for being in that position of storing oil is they're capturing that contango as profit every month. They roll their short position, they close out their short, they reopen a new short on a contract 1 month later at a higher price. And whatever that difference in price is, that's the profit. That's what they got paid for storing the oil in the tank. And they continue to roll their short forward, and it's hedged by the long exposure they have in the physical market because they've got oil in their tank. Well, when we start to get to curves moving in backwardation, the storage guys say, hey, wait a minute, there's no benefit to me in continuing to store oil here. If I'm going to have to roll my contract forward, my short contract, forward to a lower priced contract, which would be the case in backwardation, why would I do that? I'll just deliver my oil out of that tank into the market and empty my tank and close my position completely. Why would I take a loss on continuing to store oil and pay for the pleasure of doing so? That doesn't make any sense. So it's that storage-driven selling that pushes the front end of the WTI curve back down. And what it's basically telling us is there's a demand in the marketplace for storage. We need to store oil because there's a little bit more than we actually have buyers for right this instant. Why don't you see that in the Brent curve? Because there is no Cushing, Oklahoma tank farm associated with the Brent futures contract. It's cash settled. So that's the reason that I believe that difference exists. And I want to stress again, there are some people who think it's driven by completely different factors. I'm convinced what I've just described is accurate. I wouldn't be surprised if Chris Cook, who's a very knowledgeable guy, has a completely different view about how it works. Let us know, folks, if you want us to set up a separate show at some point with Chris on this subject. It's kind of an unusual topic. I don't know how much interest there actually is.
All right, well, let's go to chart three, where I actually have a crude oil, the WTI crude oil futures daily chart. And I want to just talk about this price action and some of the levels that you're watching and where I'm watching as well. This kind of $50-$52 area was fascinating to me from a technical perspective, because that if there was going to be a short-term bounce, that was a very logical support line that would have held. And if obviously it was broken, that's where some of the lower targets would come in. But with this bounce, it's being driven by the geopolitical news. At least that's the backdrop that's been created with the Iranian tensions escalating again. I'm fascinated with what happens in the high 50s as we approach 60. Because in my mind, so long as the price stays below 60, then the window remains for this to roll over and sell again. But at the same time, that 60 is a line in the sand in my mind, because if the tensions, political tensions continue to escalate and we see this ripping north of 60, that might actually mean something different is happening. What's your take on the price action on crude?
Well, Patrick, the number one rule of the oil market is there is no limit to how much upside in price is possible when people start panicking over geopolitical events. And there's been some pretty big upside so far. Frankly, the panic over geopolitical events is small thus far. We don't have an actual war. We've got some pretty crazy things happening, and it looks like there's probably going to be more military engagement between the United States and Iran. The place you really get worried is when there's a conflict that has the potential to have contagion. So it starts between two different actors and then other people pile in. And certainly, if at any point you were to hear Russia say, look, Iran's our ally, we're going to come to Iran's defense here. And so it becomes a proxy war being fought in Iran, really between the U.S. and Russia. Holy cow, anything is possible to the upside in oil prices if something like that were to occur. I don't think that is going to occur. I think that Iran is acting in a way that's going to result in some military engagement with the United States. I don't think Russia's likely to come to their aid. I don't think anybody else is. The amount of Iranian production that might be taken offline is really a gray market factor anyway because of the sanctions. So I don't really see it having that much to do with oil prices. It's the contagion risk to a larger conflict across the region that involves other countries and that grows into a bigger war that you have to worry about. And so far, I think what we're seeing is just a flinch in the market. I also think that the fundamentals in terms of supply and demand and storage and everything else that we talk about regarding the oil market are still in place for new lows below $50. I think that if all of the sudden, all of this geopolitical stuff suddenly blew over, the market would very quickly roll over and we'd be back down below 50 before we knew it. At this point, I don't think there's really a good play here other than to step back and wait and see. I don't dare to short this here because who knows what could happen next in the geopolitical news flow. I do think it's quite likely, though, that if the geopolitics blow over, that the fundamentals in the oil market are going to take us lower. But Patrick, I want to move on to slide four, because the last few weeks, you've been pretty clear in saying, hey, you're sticking to your guns. This is a topping formation, and maybe we'll see a new all-time high. But if so, it's time to sell it. It looks like from this chart, you're starting to look at the potential of a serious leg higher. Has your thinking changed?
Well, no, actually, my thinking hasn't changed, really. I'm still in the camp that this is a topping formation. But the thing that I really wanted to get across with this chart is sort of just putting into context what are the two scenarios I'll play out. I have to contend with Kevin Muir on a weekly basis. And obviously, him, like Brent Johnson, is very much in that bull camp where they're expecting some sort of a melt-up move. And it's something that we have conversations about on the show on an ongoing basis as well. And what I really wanted to get across with page four was just that this is no longer just about a move to 3,000. If the bull scenario was what ends up manifesting itself, while I'm not in that camp and I don't think that that's what's happening, if it was to manifest, this thing isn't stopping at 3,000. And so what I did was just put on a technical measured move, and I wanted to highlight three measured targets that are on the upside that if it was the bull narrative that materialized, where would it likely go? And what's interesting is that it heads towards 3,400 on the top end of that range. So in this kind of 32 to 3,400 are where all these targets lie. And so, you know, if I am proven wrong about this being a topping formation and this rips, I mean, there is a solid 10%+ upside potential on a bull breakout in the summer. Not what I think will happen, but that's definitely would be where I'd be targeting if it proves to be the case.
Well, Patrick, I've definitely adjusted my thinking here because as much as I think we're seeing recession signals and lots of reasons to think the business cycle is late cycle and time for things to roll over, the reality is the market hasn't been really following those signals. The market's been reacting to this bad is the new good doctrine, where as economic conditions worsen, people anticipate that the Fed is going to be more accommodative. They love that accommodative easy money policy, and that actually drives markets higher counterintuitively. as much as it doesn't make any sense to me, it's what's been happening, and it's been happening for a long time now, and it seems like it's going to continue happening. And if I think about what could happen here, let's assume that we do break into real new all-time high territory. And at the same time, we continue to see bond yields tumbling, which I think ought to concern the market. It doesn't make sense that the bond market is showing us recession signs and the stock market is racing higher. But if we're going to get lower interest rates as a result of this move now testing 2% on the 10-year as we're speaking, it's going to mean more corporate buybacks. And more corporate buybacks is going to push the market higher. And if I'm right about the dollar, then the Brent Johnson scenario comes into play, where what happens is for foreign investors who are getting frustrated with the situations in their countries, the U.S. stock market just looks incredible because, first of all, it is breaking out, despite the disbelief of some of us that are watching. It is breaking out to new all-time highs. We are in this environment that's conducive to more corporate buybacks. And if you're a foreign investor who's also, as a result of investing in U.S. stocks, getting the benefit of that foreign exchange boost as the dollar continues to appreciate, that's another reason to pile in. So I do think there's plenty of room for that Brent Johnson scenario of a melt-up to occur. And what I want to suggest, Patrick, I personally am not about to say, oh, okay, well, it's time here at new all-time highs that don't make any economic sense to me on a fundamental level to just buy and hold stocks for the long term. I'm not going to do that. But I've also made a huge mistake of missing a lot of the upside in the market in the last few years because I didn't believe in the fundamentals. And what I want to talk about, Patrick, is options strategies that can be used to play a melt-up. If you think what's going to happen is prices are going to just go crazy high until there's a blow-off top and a crash, outright crash, which I think is probably coming someday, but it's a good chance that we're going to melt up to much higher prices before it happens. How do I ride that wave up using options so that I'm not exposed when the crash happens? And I think there's a number of different strategies having to do with low delta calls that you roll over every month. There's different ways of doing that. Why don't we do a whole post-game segment about how to play a melt-up if you don't believe in the fundamentals? Because that's something I'm very interested in.
Well, for sure. And I've done a presentation in the past for Macro Voice listeners on the ratio call spreads as one of the ways, but we can focus more on just the idea of rolling call options, with especially when there's low vol conditions, as a way to participate on the upside there. With that said, though, I want to move on to charts 5 and 6, because this is where I continue to be torn. When we look at the scenario where this could be like 1998, the narrative we've heard from a number of these guests and other pundits out there, and it could rip higher. But what if this is just continues to being a topping formation? And what I wanted to do is on chart 5 was show the S&P 500 back in 1998, and looking at 1998 through 2001, and particularly from its 1999 high, what ended up happening was into the 2000, when the NASDAQ was melting up, each time the S&P 500 rallied, it just rallied to a slightly higher high and gave it back. It rallied to a higher high and then gave it back, just modest little bumps higher that ended up developing a much longer 14-month topping formation in the S&P 500 that ultimately marked the top. So to me, even if the market pokes to a little bit of a higher high, just like what happened in 2000, 2001, there is always the chance that this is still just one bigger topping formation developing. And this is where the big, you know, $64,000 question is, are we going to get this last melt up where the market just keeps ripping higher? Or is this just once again the market retesting those previous highs before it rolls over again? I'm a bit on the other camp, though. I still am skeptical of this rally. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. But right now, even if this market pokes to a little bit of a higher high, I'm still skeptical of whether or not this is going to sustain.
Well, I certainly share your skepticism on some levels, which is I don't think any of this makes any sense. This bad is the new good doctrine is nutso. But, you know, we're in totally uncharted territory. We've never had monetary policy conditions, anything like this. We don't know what can happen here. And I am definitely coming much more around to saying, you know, as much as I have not in any way, shape, or form changed my convictions that these prices don't make any sense, the reality is there's a lot of reasons to think they're going to make even less sense and keep going up. And if you look at what we're seeing in the tape action, it's not time to be super confident that this is a topping formation. I think there's a good possibility of that, but we've got to start thinking about what happens if, you know, liquidity wins out over fundamentals, as crazy as it sounds. But Patrick, before we move on from this slide, I want to ask you for an update on the calendared straddle strategy that we discussed with our listeners on Macro Voices several weeks ago. How's that going? You guys were straddling from the old high. It was going great for a while. What's going on now that we're kind of back to all-time highs?
Well, you know, one of the key things that we do is we put in adjusting trades at key technical levels. And one of the things we did when the S&P was down around the 2800 level, we actually rolled down the call option within there to lock in an intrinsic value. So now that we've been making these adjusting trades, even though the market's back up to its highs, we're in a situation where we're still in a modest profit. And it's a testament to the strategy where we had all of the potential to make money if this was the big kahuna short, but at the same time, we're not getting killed in any way, even though the market has rallied back up. And so anyway, we're still in the trade. I'm debating whether or not we need to reposition or just get out of the trade at this moment and then look for another entry. But that's something that we're going to be doing with our members in the coming weeks and months.
Well, my hat's off to you, Patrick, because if you can put on a huge short bet, which is essentially what you did, and have what's happened happen and still end up basically breaking even or even making a couple of bucks, you're doing great as far as I'm concerned. So congratulations on that. But let's move on to the gold chart. Holy cow. This is, what, 5 years now that we've been stuck below that 1350 to 1375 level. As we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, I'm looking at 1393, just about a dollar over the 1392 that you have on this chart here. So what point, I mean, you're the technician, Patrick, when you have a consolidation like this that's been running 5 years, what do you need to see in order to be persuaded that this is a real breakout and not just a fake break?
This has been a trade range since 2013, right? And some argue that the actual bottom of the bear market was in that 2015, early 2016 low, and that this is just a market that's been basing. Now, on a monthly chart, you're looking for a monthly close above there. So I think a lot of people are going to be watching as we approach the end of June, whether or not we close at this 1400 plus range. To me, there was a lot of short-term technical moves that were measuring out toward 1400. If this was just a swing trade, this is where it should stop. So this is such an interesting level to me, because if we're technically breaking north of 1400, then something much bigger is happening. And so even though on the chart here, it looks like it's breaking to a higher high, I still want more confirmation. And I think once we get north of 1400 with any gusto, that's where I think they could really start to build momentum. And it'll be very hard for it to turn back and turn bearish from there. And so this is a very important turn point in gold in my mind.
And I want to add something to that, Patrick, which is I think this is a very difficult breakout to gauge. And the reason is, first of all, you've got all kinds of geopolitical tensions that have pushed us up to this level above the red line there. You know, is that a temporary effect, or are we really seeing something structural in the market? And there is a very good argument for that something structural in the market, which is central banks seem to have taken a change of direction where they're headed back toward lower rates. That's got to be good for gold. Most people think it's going to be bad for the dollar. The thing is, even if Brent Johnson and I are right, and the dollar is going to continue to appreciate, potentially causing gold to reverse direction and move lower here, I wouldn't expect that to happen overnight. I think you've got to see the move down in the dollar index in reaction to expectations about a rate cut first, and that's got to kind of play out and then surprise everybody when the dollar turns around. That could take a few days. So, you know, at what point do you declare that it really is not happening? The dollar is really done. Greg gave us a level that he's watching on the dollar index. And certainly if we see a close below that, it's maybe time to think about this again. But I think it's difficult to call the point where you say, okay, this breakout is real? I think we've got so many different factors, and that creates a risk. If you're waiting for that confirmation, you could miss the move, and you know you're above 1,500 by the time you get in. So I see it as a dicey trading situation, to say the very least.
All right. Well, listen, what I wanted to touch on, though, is silver, because everyone's gold, gold, gold. And when we had Adam Collins on and we were looking at the COT reports, one of the things he shared with all of our listeners several weeks back was the fact that silver was at a pretty extreme positioning when you're looking at it as a percentile of net positioning in the commitment of trader reports, as speculators were incredibly heavy short and commercial hedgers were not, that we were at pretty extreme levels. And what's interesting is silver has really been unloved. And when you look at it, I put on a weekly chart here, and you can really see that silver has not even started to move properly in any way resembling gold. And I'm wondering whether the gold's little cousin silver has a lot more upside here on a relative basis if it suddenly gets the tailwind of a lot of these speculative shorts starting to have to cover if, in fact, its breakout is for real. So watching how silver behaves here is going to be really interesting. With that said, I wanted to just leave it with one last chart. I wanted to touch on corn. I heard Greg talking about, obviously, he likes the soybean because corn has run a little bit. But I wanted to give some historical perspective as to when corn really runs, what a run looks like. And you have to go all the way back to 2010 and 2012 because, I mean, we've had, you know, 5 years of pretty good growing conditions in corn, which have not seen any real spikes. But if you go back and really look at the history of the price action, there are ample examples of times where corn even doubled in its price. And while we have seen that move from 3.5 to like 4.5 on corn, you know, if this flooding and the growing conditions are as bad as some of the people are suggesting, maybe this isn't done. I mean, I think there's a room for corn to keep going.
Well, Patrick, we definitely need to keep an eye on all of these markets. And for our listeners who want Patrick's help doing that, be sure to check out the free 14-day trial offer at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time for today's episode, which was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free book and subscribe to their podcast as well. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices yourself, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And finally, don't forget to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which contains links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet, including supplemental information from our feature interview guests. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find that transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Greg Weldon's presentation slides, as well as charts we discussed here in the postgame. There's also an article from Harley Bassman, the Convexity Maven, titled "For Propeller Heads Only," and a variant perception article talking about those sky-high corn prices adding to inflation pressures. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.